Hey everyone, welcome to the Delta Flyers with Tom and Harry as we journey through episodes of Star Trek Voyager. Your two hosts along this journey are my fellow Trek actor, who also portrayed the role of Sam in the 1993 TV movie Spies, Mr. Robert Duncan McNeil, and myself, your favorite eternal ensign, Garrett Wong. Remember, you can get the full version of this podcast by signing up to become a patron at patreon.com/the Delta Flyers. Does that bring back memories Sam. There, buddy? Sam, were you a Coast Guard dude, Sam?
Oh, is that what was my. I was a Coast Guard. Yeah, it was.
A young Coast Guard.
Here's what I remember about that
sailor
spot. Yeah, it was a Disney Channel before there was like all the Disney XD and all
yes,
the.
Yes. There was only one Disney Channel.
One yeah. Disney Channel. And they tried to have like for little kids programming in the morning
yes.
and then a little older. And then in the evening and on the weekends, they had family stuff like family movies and things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the old, you know, Wonderful World of Disney movies.
Yes.
So this was a Disney Channel movie about World War II era. And there were German U-boats off the coast of Long Island. And I was a Coast Guard guy. And I had a crush on his older sister, I think, or something like that.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't really remember the plot. Here's the things. Here's the highlights of Spies, the Disney Channel film. Cloris Leachman was in it.
Oh, wow. Nice. And
I remember being so excited to work with Cloris Leachman.
Yeah.
But then I realized I'm stuck in a van driving to location with her for an hour and change each day. And she talks and she had so many opinions. And I was like, oh my God, I love you, Cloris, but like no more for an hour and a half every day, each way in the van.
It.
But she was awesome.
Yeah.
A legend. And my other two things I remember is we shot it in Wilmington, North Carolina. And it was the very first time that I had worked in Wilmington. I ended up working on a couple other things there, but Wilmington was a little film town for a while, for a couple of a decade or two. They had a lot of filming. They had a studio, and I'm from North Carolina. So when I went to do this, the very first time I filmed, my grandparents came, my dad came, my sister, little sister, like,
This was a big deal for you.
It was a big deal because I was like, oh my God, I'm doing my job and I can see family and they can come see me do it. And it was amazing.
That is so cool. So what do you think happened with that decade long dynasty or not a dynasty, but for a decade, Wilmington was putting out a lot.
I would say for about 20 years.
Okay.
So they had the state of North Carolina had some big tax incentives and very cheap labor force.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to make a TV movie of the week, you could use a non-union crew and your locations were cheap. Everything about it was cheap. And they had tax incentives and they had this little town, historic town of Wilmington, which you could play for anything. You could almost play it for New York City if you wanted.
Got it.
Or you could play it for a small town. You had the water, you had suburbs. It was a great, I did Spies there. I did One Tree Hill for a couple of years that I directed on it. I did Dawson's Creek for a couple of years that I directed. It was a great little town. I loved it.
Why did they lose that prominence of being that one, you know, awesome place to go film at? Did they get undercut by Georgia or?
Georgia passed some really competitive.
Even better than North Carolina.
Bigger. Yeah. And they had more to offer because they had Atlanta as a big city. They had Savannah as a historic city.
Yeah.
All kinds of mountains, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And North Carolina was just like, we're not going to get into a tax incentive race. To spend money with Georgia. We're just not going to, that's not our business. We don't want to do it. So they got rid of them. And I feel like One Tree Hill was one of the last things that ended up as part of that dynasty. And now there's occasional filming there. They still have the studios in Wilmington. I don't know how often they get used, but.
So the Bulldogs knocked off the Tar Heels.
Yes, they did.
So sad. But you were there during the heyday.
It was great.
Sam, the Coast Guard guy.
Look at this. So. I just realized I'm drinking my coffee for this meeting.
I can see
Of one of our, this is our current Delta Flyers merch mug.
Yeah.
I beat the Borg with it. There's Janeway.
I love it. Yeah.
With a Borg cube and her cup of coffee.
Wow.
And
I love that mug.
It's a great mug. I just realized I looked down and I'm like, oh, I've got.
You're actually using it.
I am full on.
You're wearing your Tom Paris plate shirt.
Tom Paris plate shirt on. I got my Delta Flyers hat on.
Oh my god!
Amazing Delta Flyers mug that everyone should drink their morning coffee with Janeway. Yeah.
I do want you to watch the other episodes of Lower Decks. I know you've seen We'll Always Have Tom Paris. You've seen that episode, but you really need to. You need to watch the other eps, man. They're really good.
I know. They are really good.
Okay. But I love that you have all the merch on. It's wonderful. And also, I want to watch you as Sam, the Coast Guard guy. I want to see. Do you have a copy of this? Your dad has to have a copy of it.
I bet my dad and his collection of VHSs somewhere. I'd have to go look.
It's on VHS. It has to be. You told me that he recorded everything that you were on practically, right? So,
well, it's a Disney. I wonder if on Disney Plus.
Oh,
I'm going to have to take a look. Maybe it's got to be in their library somewhere.
Ooh,
that would be interesting.
I'm going to go look. I can't wait to see. Yeah. Okay. Well, speaking of looking at stuff, we need to look at this episode.
Let's look at it. All right.
Yeah. So this week's episode is Relativity. And Robbie and I will be right back after we watch Relativity. It's been a while since we've seen it last. So we're going to watch. Yeah. Yep. We'll be right back with our review, recap, discussion of Relativity. And for all of our Patreon patrons, please stay tuned for your bonus material. Okie dokie. We are back from watching Relativity.
Yes, we are. And it was not about a relative city. I thought it was... I was wrong.
You were wrong. That's okay. It happens.
Yeah.
Relative.
I try to remember. I do the best that I can.
You did. Robbie was referring to our a little discussion in the bonus material section about what he thought the synopsis was. So it was quite funny. For those of you who haven't subscribed yet, it's a good thing. Check out the full episode through Patreon.com.
Yeah, I was wrong.
It's all right, buddy. That's okay. Okay, let's start off with our poetry synopsis. And here we go with my haiku for Relativity. Temporal weapon. Deck 4, section 39. Sevens save the day. Plural seven.
Get it?
Get the plural
sevens. Seven of nine.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, here we go with our limerick then.
Limerick me.
I'm going to limerick all over you. Here we go.
Oh, I can't wait.
All right. Our limerick for Relativity goes a little something like this. A time travel episode. Here we go again. Ugh. Someone is trying to destroy Voyager like a thug. Seven of nine to seven of nine. Turns out Braxton is a swine. They fixed it, but my brain hurts and I need a hug.
Wow, you took some artistic license there by using the word ugh, which is probably debatable whether or not that exists
a word
in the dictionary.
It's an expression.
Okay, all right, I'll let you slide on that one.
Okay. Ugh.
Yes. Okay. All righty. Very good. Yeah. Can you give us the breakdown on guest stars right now?
Yeah, please? The actors. It was a wonderful group of actors. First of all, Braxton, our time traveling captain. Bruce McGill is his name. He was on our show before.
No, he's recast.
What?
Yes.
He wasn't the Braxton.
No, he's not the original Braxton, which is really, I was, because when I saw him, I'm like, wait a minute, that's not the guy from Future's End Part 1 and 2. And then I went back and looked. Future's End Part 1 and 2, Braxton, is portrayed by actor Alan G. Royal.
Bruce McGill
replaced him in this one. So that's
I just looked that up.
Yeah. So that's something that really kind of, I don't recall what the drama, if there was any drama, or it could have easily been Alan Royal's agent called up and said, I'm sorry, Alan's already preoccupied on filming, you know, this film in Czechoslovakia. He cannot.
Yeah, it could have been a scheduling
conflict.
Oh, sure. That's so funny because I just went with it when I saw Bruce McGill. I was like, oh yeah, Bruce McGill, I remember
it's
him.
Okay. Bruce McGill is in every freaking, I mean, he's you've seen this guy's
so
face
many,
over
so many
and over
movies.
Again.
Okay, yeah. He's from San Antonio, Texas.
Okay.
His very first job that I could find was a independent film called Citizens Band. This was a movie from 1977. If you remember CB radios, remember CB?
Yes.
CB radios were
10-4, good buddy. Yeah.
10-4, good buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was all very popular in popular culture. Uh-huh. CB radios were everywhere. And so this was a movie about a community of people who only knew each other through CB radios.
Oh my goodness.
So his character was named Blood. There were other characters like Electric and Snake, and that was their handle on CB radio. So it sounds like a really corny, but it was kind of like before, it was the internet before the internet. Like it was people who could sort of get on their CB radio. They didn't have to see people face to face. They could create whatever persona that they wanted on their CB radio. And I don't know the movie, but I would imagine it probably was a exploration of that idea before you had the internet and things, you know.
And that was 1977. So he was born in 1950. So he was 27 years old when he first portrayed that character about CB radios.
Blood. Bruce McGill, Citizens Band, his first movie. He's also probably most known for Animal House, where he played Daniel Simpson Day.
That's right.
A year after he was in Animal House. So among other legends. Dakin Matthews plays Patterson, Admiral Patterson, Janeway's teacher. His first job was Remington Steel back in 1985.
Oh my goodness.
Remington Steel TV show.
Goodness gracious.
Next one I've got here is Jay Carnes, who played Duquesne. Mm. I have to say, I did a play with Jay. I forgot he was on our show.
My goodness.
I did an amazing production of Romeo and Juliet. Jay played Mercutio. He actually took over for an actor who was fired. But Jay took over late in the rehearsal process for Mercutio and did a phenomenal job.
Who does he look like to you?
I don't know. Who does he look like to you?
The Lost Carradine brother.
Oh, he
looks like Robert Carradine, Lewis Skolnick from Revenge of the Nerds. I'm looking at him going, this is his doppelganger almost. Very similar look.
Mm. He does.
Okay.
Jay's first job was in 1990. He had done some theater, gone to school for theater, right around the time that I met him doing a play in 91.
Yeah.
It was on a soap opera called Generations.
Oh,
and it was a very short-lived soap back in those days. About 3 years it ran. Mm-hmm. It was basically Generations was about kind of followed a Caucasian family and an African American family.
Oh,
kind of the stories about how they dealt with the world. So it was an interesting concept. Last actor we've got here is Josh Clark, who plays Lieutenant Carey.
Good old Carey. What was his first job? I want to know that. I don't know that.
The first thing that I could find
was
1976.
Oh, 1 year before Bruce McGill's first role.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a long time ago.
A long time ago. He must have been very young. But anyway, he did a TV movie called The Other Side of Victory, which starred Mark Margolis and David Naughton.
Wow.
David Naughton was known for his Dr. Pepper commercials and also An American Werewolf in London.
Oh, that David Naughton. Yes.
That David Naughton. And Mark Margolis is mostly known for, I think, Pet Detective. He was in the Pet Detective movies. Yeah. And also all of the Darren Aronofsky films like Black Swan and Pi. And kind of an art house.
Regarding David Naughton, you just connected two dots for me. I had no idea that the guy from American Werewolf in London is the same one that sang, I'm a pepper, you're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper
too? That's David Naughton.
That's him?
Oh, yep.
My God. I can see him right now. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, that's our guest stars.
It was
directed by Alan Eastman. We were wrong. It was not.
Well, it wasn't Wendell. Alan.
It wasn't Alan. It was not Alan Craker or Terry Wendell or Les Landau. It was Alan Eastman. I think he did two episodes and this was his second one.
I had to look him up. I actually Googled him just to see his face. And I do remember his face. I do remember his face now. And interesting enough, this Alan, like the other Alan, Alan Craker, they're both Canadian.
Canadian.
They both hail from the Great White North. So. There is another factoid.
Story by Nick Sagan, teleplay by Brian Fuller, Nick Sagan, and Michael Taylor. Yeah. So we were way off on writers and directors.
That's right. That's okay.
but a very clever story. And
very much so.
Yeah. So there we go. There's our lineup.
Thank you for sharing that. Let's start this episode off with our opening shot of an amazing Utopia Planitia, is what it's called, which is the dry dock area. This is where Starfleet essentially builds starships. And it's located on Mars. At some point, it gets destroyed. But, at this point in time, and for this episode, it's a very bustling and a very cool
opening shot, because we're kind of out there in space. The camera sort of floating around and seeing all these ships being worked on, these Starfleet ships.
Yeah.
And eventually it sort of reveals the Delta.
You were going to say the Delta Flyer. Okay.
The Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
In dry dock, reveals it, and it's a very cool opening shot. Great visual effects.
Yeah.
And then we go inside, and Janeway, she beams up aboard into a hallway there, and she's greeted by Admiral Patterson.
Yeah.
Who basically says, "You're late," and dives right into a pop quiz, which I thought was very funny, because he's like, "You're late. Wait, did she beam into the hallway? No, I'm mixing
up." No.
They're actually
in the transporter room.
They're in the transporter room.
But before you go to that, let me finish saying, when you said the Voyager. I just want to bring up, this is a little sidebar here, that one of the more recent episodes of Strange New Worlds, that's with Anson Mount as Captain Pike. He actually is in the transporter room and he greets the guest, and he does not say "welcome to the Enterprise." He says "welcome to Enterprise." He says without the
Really?
Yes.
That seems strange to me.
No, but I like it that way, because I would rather say "welcome to Voyager" instead of "welcome to the Voyager." I've always been I'm a guy. I know you're a the guy, and that's why we work well together. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
If you have a boat named Floaty McFloaterface, that's your boat name, and you invite somebody, "Hey, come meet me on the boat. We're going to go water ski and hang out on the boat." Yeah. They get on. You would say, "Welcome to the Floaty McFloatface." You would say that. You wouldn't say, "Welcome to Floaty McFloat." Like,
I like "welcome to Floaty McFloatface." I'm
welcome
okay with that.
To welcome the to Floaty. This is the boat. If I say "welcome to Voyager," then it's like I'm giving a welcome to someone named Voyager. Welcome to Voyager. Welcome to Harry. Welcome to Janeway. And welcome to Voyager. I'm giving welcomes to each.
You know, I hear you.
Welcome to the. Now you are welcome to the place called Voyager.
You know, it's a valid argument. I'm fine with what you're saying, but I'm going to say tomato, tomato. Some people say tomato, some people say tomato. And I like it without the.
Tomato, tomato.
I don't think you need the article, but you like the, and I'm like, we could do without. So,
okay.
All right. We digress. So,
but my big takeaway from this is, if I get a boat, I'm naming it Floaty McFloaty.
Floaty McFloaty? Oh, Floaty McFloat Face.
Face, yes. I think there was a Boaty McBoat Face contest. Yeah. I'm stealing it and just calling it Floaty. Okay. We definitely digress.
We digressed a lot. Okay.
We did.
Let's go back into it. So they are in the transporter room, and Janeway, with old Janeway hairdo, beams in.
Yes.
So this is our first indication.
She's got a bun.
Yeah, there's the bun of steel. It's there. It's back again.
Yes.
And it's like immediately you're thinking, what is happening here? But she is being basically greeted by her old teacher, Admiral Patterson. He's there with a little pop quiz for her and ask her a few, questions, science questions, and she answers them.
I wrote it down. So she comes in late and he's like, "All right, pop quiz." He doesn't actually say that, but she comes in late and he goes, "You're late." Silence, awkward silence. He goes, "What is the threshold of the H2 molecule?" She goes, 14.7 electron volts. He goes, "Third brightest star in Orion." She goes, "Viewed from where?" He goes, "Earth." She goes, "Gamma Orionis, or Bellatrix, if you prefer the original Arabic name." Bam! That's how they do it.
Okay.
It's like immediately back into I'm the teacher. It was like, what is happening? But I liked the attitude they had.
I do like the attitude, and I'm glad that you were able to, you know, show a little bit of, you were able to science a bit just now, a little sauce. But at the same time, you're in your delivery. Came off a little bit sensual, a bit.
It was like a little hostile, angry sex. They were going to have angry sex, I think. She's going to have angry sex with her old, whatever kind of teacher. What was he? He was her calculus teacher, or physics or something. I don't know, science teacher.
Some type of science field.
Science. They get all excited about science.
Okay,
but yes, she's got a bun. And by the way, Richard Starstead is standing there right behind her. Right behind the Admiral, Richard Starstead, who was Robert Beltran's stand-in.
Yes.
On the show. We love Richard. He's awesome. Always there. Such a good guy. And I just bring it up because he continues with them on the whole tour. He's like Mr. Number Two to the Admiral, which I thought, good for you, Richard.
He's like the Admiral's attaché.
Attaché in the whole run. Every time we see the Admiral, there's Richard. Okay, so finally after the quiz, they hug it out, which I thought was very sweet. Because it was like, what is happening at first with these questions, science questions? It's like this pop quiz. But they hug it out and you realize that she's come on board Voyager for the very first time.
She's getting a tour.
She's getting her first tour, first one. So they walk down a hall. She's looking around the ship.
Yeah.
It's a great little hallway walk. People are working on panels everywhere. They end up at the turbo lift and they get inside. She knows every detail of the ship. She says she's been studying it for over 3 months now.
Yeah.
So this is basically a scene before the pilot. You know, you start to orient ourselves and we're like, oh, this is before the pilot. They reach the bridge.
Yeah.
And she starts to talk about how it's much bigger than she expected.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting.
Like a TARDIS.
She sits down in her chair
for
the very first time, and there's a nice moment there.
Yeah,
and then she's then the Admiral says, well, if you like this, come on in, I'll show you something even more exciting. And they go into the ready room. She walks in for a second. The first thing she does is order a coffee, black coffee
from the replicator,
which I thought was great.
That was good. She then asks about Tuvok. The Admiral talks about, well, you know, he's still undercover. He's on Chakotay's ship. And, you know,
we don't want to bring him out too soon.
Want to keep him undercover a little longer. Janeway then talks about the difficulty of catching Chakotay in his ship in the Badlands. It's just really difficult to maneuver amongst all the anomalies and the power surges and whatever is going on in the Badlands that cause ships to sort of like lose control. So at this point, she suggests Tom Paris and his marvelous piloting skills.
She goes off about Tom for a little while.
Waxes poetic about Tom. And
he's the guy.
Patterson is a little skeptical. He's like, really? Admiral Paris's son? I don't think that's a good choice. He's not really happy about that. But he listens to Janeway and he says, well, okay, I'll look into it. I'll take a look into that.
She says at the end of the scene something like, you know, everybody, she steps up close to the Admiral. She has this meaningful look and she's like, everybody deserves a second chance.
That's right.
And they have this long pause. And I was like, that's an interesting, it felt like there was more to the story there and he was in on it or something. I don't know. I thought that was going to go somewhere and it didn't really, that moment didn't.
Or if she had a really cryptic ending line saying, I've had my eye on young Mr. Paris for a while now. Something like that.
Something like that would have been nice.
Yeah. Would have been very suggestive. You don't know what's really going on there. Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Then we move to the bridge again. Mm-hmm. They go back over to Paris's future station, the Con down at the front.
With some kind of panel or something out that I was like, what the heck is that? I've never seen that part of the
Con down there.
Station.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah. There's some type of, you know, some type of wiring going on or whatever it may be. Some type of diagnostic. It's being run by a crew person who then turns around into camera and we see it is 7 of 9 in a medical or science colored uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And it is 7. And I remember very clearly In the script, she was supposed to be wearing Operation/Security Gold. That was her uniform. Yes, that was her uniform.
Oh, that's right. And she didn't like refused the color.
No, she didn't. She says, I do not want to wear this color. And they, you know, they listened to her request and boom, she's wearing green now. You know, for me, I felt a little.
Oh, she didn't
My feelings were hurt. Yeah, my feelings were hurt. I was just like, really? You didn't go with the gold, team gold? And, but you know, that's her choice. And she
Well, you've talked about this. Like, she felt like it didn't flatter her skin or it washed her out or something like that.
Well, yeah, because she saw it on me. I don't think you should have gold if you're Asian. You know, I mean, it's just the worst color for an Asian. The better color for an Asian is going to be green or red. So on me, on a day-to-day basis, I think she probably said, oh, it's not very complimentary. Aww. Yeah, so.
But I bet she was thrilled to be out of that bodysuit. That
oh my gosh, she must have been bodysuit. And you know, she didn't have to have any of the implants on her face too. So she just
didn't have any prosthetics.
Oh my gosh, she probably felt that was the easiest day of hair and makeup she's ever had. Mm-hmm. So she's ecstatic, clearly. Yeah. And she's not wearing the tight suit as well as all the stuff that went underneath that suit.
Exactly.
Yep. But she looks good. She looks good in medical
slash science. She looks younger to me. Something about it was like less makeup maybe, or the hair was a little looser or something.
You're right. She does look more youthful. She does. That's a good call. That's a really good call.
She exits the bridge after that reveal, which was a great shot, by the way.
Yes. We come back from commercial. There's a bit of a time jump and we see the exit again from a different angle. And she walks directly into the briefing room. And then all of a sudden she contacts somebody. And you can hear her say, the bridge is clear. There's no sign of the weapon. So now we know a mystery is afoot. Something is going on. We don't know who she's talking to. And at this point, she's, you know, there's a little bit of an interruption because Janeway and Patterson entered the briefing room and catch Seven a bit doing her thing. And Janeway talks about how she doesn't really, you know, she doesn't really like the layout of the room so much. She feels like it's not as conducive to meetings.
It's not very comfortable. She says something about it's not designed very comfortably or something like that. And then she asks Seven, she's like, Ensign, what do you think?
Yeah. What's your opinion?
What's your opinion? And Seven's like, it's an efficient design. And Janeway says, oh, well, I guess I was wrong.
Yeah.
And she basically like, okay, that ensign says it's efficient. I'm good enough for me. I'm wrong.
You know, I almost
it's not wanted... comfortable in there. That was a horrible room to shoot in. It was okay.
But when she said, you know how Seven speaks, very non-human like, right? You know, yes. It's an efficient design. I almost wanted Janeway to sort of like take a double take and like, why is this human speaking this in this manner? You know, like just for a split second, just to see it a little like, hey, something's a little okay. And then go on, but you know, it didn't happen. It's okay. But we know that it's Seven.
That's interesting because I know some people as you were talking about that, like should Janeway have been aware of her speech pattern being awkward or formal or something.
Yeah.
I actually know a couple of people popped in my head that actually like have that have very formal speech patterns. And I think, I wonder if, you know, they get judged or, you know, boxed in sometimes.
Because of that speech pattern.
Yeah.
I bet you they do.
You know, one of them is a family member, a nephew of mine, and he has a very kind of formal intellectual kind of speech pattern, which I know him well. So to me, it doesn't seem unusual, but I think a lot of times that the impression is that he's not socially comfortable, which is not the case at all.
No,
which is
it's not.
He's very comfortable with that sort of data oriented, you know, concrete, formal description. So it'd be, it's just an interesting thing to think of Seven out of her Borg branding, so to speak.
Correct.
And being, you know, playing a full human.
Yes.
On the ship and how different she might seem.
Yes. Or the writers could have written her response being more colloquial.
A little more. Yeah.
And more hip sounding, right? She's undercover, you know, where she could say, it's pretty cool, you know, something like, I don't know. Yeah. That's probably too slang, but they, you know what I'm saying?
It would have been funny though. I think you're onto something. It would have been, it would have given us a lot of comedy if we had
been able to have her trying to be
yeah. casual and an opportunity to play the cover of some, you know,
completely
nothing, someone, yeah. no, nothing like Seven.
Yeah, exactly. That would have been another layer that would have added more depth and more richness to this episode.
Yeah. It would have been funny.
Okay, so in our story at this point, I think we're jumping to sick bay right now. Janeway and Patterson arrive in sick bay, mm-hmm. and they activate the EMH, who is a little bit salty because at this point he hasn't really evolved so much. He's just the EMH. Is he a trial program at this point? Or he's a new program. He's a new program.
Because the Admiral says he's got 4 million... doctors in his database, files. And when he appears, he goes, nope, 5 million.
5 million, yeah. exactly. So we have the appearance of Bob Picardo for a very short amount of time. Patterson deactivates him. We move on to engineering when we see Seven, who's wandering around trying to get her stuff done. And Lieutenant Carey sees
Seven. She's kind of creeping around engineering.
Let's face it. She's a creeper in this scene. Carey notices that he doesn't know who she is, and he walks up to come talk to her. And basically, she introduces herself as Anna Jameson. Anna. So he asks her, what are you doing here? And she says, oh, I'm just trying to realign the EPS manifold. She's thinking... She's trying to come up with something on the run there. And she's good enough that she comes up with this. And he says, well, I can help you. She says, no. And then he says, well, maybe I'll see you in the mess hall later. And she's like, well, probably not. Or unfortunate, or what is her term? She says, doubtful. And then he's like, excuse me? Yeah, what's that? And he says, oh, well, I'm on assignment. I'm not even a member of the Voyager crew. I'm just here on assignment doing a couple of things for Starfleet. And so... That's her way of
getting out. He's kind of flirty in this
scene. He's very flirty. You can tell he's trying to make a move on her.
He's trying to make a move.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And then you see her sort of sneaking back towards the Jeffries tube doors that take us to our Jeffries tube sets off engineering. Right. As she heads over there, we cut out in the hall. Janeway's heading to engineering to get the tour. And we have a little moment there where she comes in and reveal that this is the engine room for Voyager. And Janeway's seeing it for the very first time. We go back in the tubes and Seven is talking to someone,
but we don't know through the tubes.
Crawling through the tubes. She says she's located the temporal distortion. She opens another door. I did notice when that door opened, it looked back on her, the fake background of the tube behind her.
Yeah.
It didn't line up. It was like a different color. So the Jeffries tube is really only about 8 or 10 feet deep.
Yes.
And then it stopped.
That's it.
And what we would put behind it is either a green screen so that they could extend it. Mm-hmm. But that was very expensive. The other thing that they usually did was just put up this, they rolled in this photo backing that sort of sat there. And it was fine, but it was not the same color.
Right.
It was like bluer. And it was, and all of a sudden the lights that go along the perspective.
Yeah.
Change direction a little. It was just,
oh gosh, it really distracted me. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but anyway, she after I was traumatized by the fake photo and the back of all the tube, I let that go. And she steps over, opens up a panel, and she says, "I found the weapon." Yeah.
Deck 4, section 39. She's found that weapon. Mm-hmm. Somebody on the communication, however she's communicating, tells her to begin the procedure. So she starts that up. We then jump over to engineering. An alarm goes off. Janeway walks over to Lieutenant Carey and says, you know, what's going on? He says, evidently one of the EPS relays has gone offline. Janeway says, you know, this is great. I'm ready to roll up my sleeves and tackle this on my own. I'll take over Lieutenant Carey.
Dirty. Exactly.
Get all dirty. I can take care of this. And then she goes on a mission to figure out what's going on. We jump back to the Jeffries tube and we find out that the weapon is out of phase. So she can't really deactivate the weapon. She was sent to the wrong time frame. So she needs to be sent to the correct time frame by whoever. As an audience member, we still don't know who the heck is sending her.
Who she's talking to. We don't know.
Yeah, we have no clue. Yeah. No clue.
But they say, we know where the weapon is. Now we need to know when.
Yeah, exactly. When was it placed? Because that's that we need to intercept that person before they place it in that section of the Jeffries tube. We jump back to engineering, where Janeway has noticed that the hatch that goes from engineering into the Jeffries tube was locked from the inside. So very mysterious. And clearly there's some type of intruder. Somebody is on the ship. And then with her tricorder, she reads some type of chronotone flux. Patterson quickly tells security to seal off deck four. So now force fields are going into effect. And now we jump back to the Jeffries tube, and Seven now knows that she has been detected. The voice, the strange voice from the other side, tells her that there's too much interference from the weapon to beam her out. And the voice asks her to recalibrate her temporal transport beam. So we now know, we have official confirmation, she is from another time in history, and that she was beamed temporally aboard this Voyager in this time frame. And now we jump to the corridor, and we have Janeway and Patterson accessing the Jeffries tube from a different section, a different part of the ship.
I just gotta say something here. So Patterson and Janeway and
Tuvok is there too as well.
So, and Tuvok.
Yeah.
But they don't really have weapons on them. I mean,
I thought they had phasers. Didn't they have phasers? No?
Oh. I don't know. Well, later on when they get caught in the middle, they don't have phasers. So it would be a continuity problem if they had them in one timeline and didn't in another. But it just seemed like if you read this, chronoton flux is there and there's an intruder locking doors. Like, it could be many people. They could be into a big battle here. Wouldn't you bring more than the admiral? Wouldn't you actually take the admiral away from the danger? Yeah, I was just like, what? Are you really gonna just you guys, three or four people, gonna go see what's up?
Yes, okay. wouldn't you take the venerated admiral who's served Starfleet for all these years away from the front line away of danger? Yes, you probably would. But instead it is Janeway and Patterson.
By the way, they're scientists, right? Like the whole emphasis is we're scientists. Hey. I'm gonna give you a pop quiz. We are not the special forces, special ops that go in when we detect temporal flux situations and locked corridors.
Okay, so they're not Section 31, but I will say this, Janeway's weapon that she has with her and Patterson is science. They have science.
They can,
they can
blinded them with science. Blinded them with science. Okay, I just had to do a little Thomas Dolby.
Thomas Dolby. Look at that. You are pulling back from the 80s. I love that.
Okay.
Okay.
So, anyway, so they go in.
Yes, they go in. They send Tuvok in another direction.
Yes, as foolish as they are. Yes, Tuvok goes the other way. Mm-hmm. So even more dangerous for the admiral. But anyway.
Yeah. So now we have Seven in the Jeffries tube, and the disembodied voice tells her to scramble the locking mechanism before they can get in and this and that. But, that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Now we have the very first shot of the temporal starship bridge interior. We have a captain. That's Captain Braxton. And of course, at this point, I'm watching him going like, who is that guy? And I know it's Bruce McGill, but I'm thinking,
that's funny because I just went with it. I'm like, Braxton. Oh yeah, Bruce, he's back. Right. I recognize it. I was like, I recognize him.
Yeah, no, you recognize him from a billion things he's done, but not Voyager.
Not the previous.
Exactly. Whoopsie. So Captain Braxton, played by Bruce McGill, is now ordering a beam out of Seven. And Lieutenant Duquesne, which we find out his name way later, but not now, but we're going to say it now. Lieutenant Duquesne, a.k.a. Robert Carradine, he says that there is just way too much interference. And if they pull her out now, it might damage her biogenetic implants. And I don't know if you noticed this, but as I was watching, Megan goes, look at their comm badges. I'm looking. She goes, it's the Chronoworks logo. I thought, holy moly, mind blown. And it's like, oh my God, it's not a Starfleet logo. It's a Chronoworks logo. So interesting. From Future Zen Part 1 and 2. But I do like their uniforms. I thought those uniforms.
I did too. I liked
Bob Blackman came up with.
The
Oh, yeah.
The sideways crazy thing.
Side thing. Yeah. With the little, so the colors on that little, off, it's basically off centered, right? It's a little sliver of color there, but everything else is a dark gray. So I really liked what Bob Blackman did with that. They look really cool. We jump to the Jeffries tube and Janeway and Patterson enter, but yet there's no sign of Seven. She's been beamed out. And therein lies the mystery of the chronoton flux that Janeway has no clue as to the answer of that. And now we jump over to the temporal starship's transporter room. Seven beams in and immediately falls to the ground. And then that's when Duquesne informs the audience that she is dead. And of course,
wait a minute.
What?
Jerry Ryan's dead?
Yeah.
Seven of Nine. What is happening?
Almost
here?
Dead or dead, dead. So I bring in a Princess Bride.
But it's a time. By the way, I'm just going to be transparent here.
Yeah.
These timeline stories make my brain hurt. Like
they are. They're painful.
So painful because it just all of a sudden you're like, oh, nothing. Everything's possible, so nothing matters. Like.
It's still cool though. I do enjoy seeing a good timeline. For me, I do. It's kind of
some people love them. I'm just not. For me, I'm like as soon as you start doing timelines.
All right, scale from 1 to 10. 10 being love most, 1 being cannot stand. Where is timeline? Where is jumping around in time? Temporal storylines for you?
3.
Really?
Yeah. Not high.
Okay, I'm on the other end. I'm 8.
Really?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Mm-mm. Okay. All right.
I mean, I think like in a Back to the Future, that's the whole story is in one film. Mm-hmm. You can tell a time story in a film, but in a series where you've got multiple stories and all kinds of serialized stories. And it's like, I don't know, it starts to pull everything apart in for the other episodes to me, like as soon as you play with the time.
See, this is good. This is why we complement each other. Okay. Yeah. You are anti-temporal timeline storylines. I am for temporal timeline storylines.
I'm just cautious. I'm cautious of them.
Fine. You are the Voyager. I am Voyager. So there you go.
Okay. Just
little differences here.
All right.
All right. So now we go to the exterior shot of this temporal starship, which
and it's a cool ship.
It is sleek. It's beautiful. You know what it looks like? It looks sort of like a stealth fighter. From any military, from the U.S. military.
It looks
any
other like military, it also looks a lot like the Delta Flyer. It
Do
looks
you
like
see
a
that
really
in there too?
Big version.
No,
yes, it's got sort of similar. No. Yeah, I think
no.
so. Like Stingray kind of.
No, I don't see that at all.
Oh, I totally
it
see
it. Looks like a submarine and a stealth fighter mixed together to me.
Okay.
So, all right. But if you see Delta Flyer again,
That's I see Delta Flyer in everything.
Compliment. Yes, of course you do. Okay, so we're back on the temporal starship bridge.
Yep.
And Braxton orders Duquesne to go back in time to recruit Seven yet again, since the Seven that they have is now dead. And, Duquesne says, look, a fourth jump, Seven could suffer neural damage, even temporal psychosis, which is an affliction that nobody wants, clearly. You don't need to.
Is that something that was invented for this episode? I don't ever remember hearing
temporal
psychosis.
I think it was invented.
Temporal psychosis. And it becomes very important because that's what the dude has later on. But anyway,
it's an important point.
Very important concept.
Mm-hmm, that was created for this episode. The captain.
He orders him, recruit her again, do it.
Right.
We're going to grab her a microsecond before the explosion on Voyager, and no one will even know she's gone. And so Duquesne, follows the orders and he starts to walk over. I love the way Jake Harms did this when he was kind of.
Yeah, he calls it out. Yeah.
I wrote it down. He goes, as he's walking over to the center of the bridge, he goes, raise shields, time frame, star date 528.61.274, Delta Quadrant. Special coordinates 87 theta by 271. Target USS Voyager.
Very theatrical.
I loved it.
He
did it like,
with some panache, with a little zhuzh.
Real panache.
Yeah, because he could have easily just rattled that off like he was bored, but no, he performed that. And I thought.
And he did it again later.
And I loved it though.
Whenever they were jumping time, like that. It's like, okay, this is my thing that I do. Yeah.
But you know what I like about it, though, Robbie? I like the fact that he makes it loud. He makes it, he projects to the back of the house. But if you think about it, you can't mess up with temporal coordinates. You need to be very, very clear about in time you're going. So this is probably status quo. And for Jay to come up with this, or maybe the director who came up with this, I don't know who, it's brilliant. Makes sense to me. You know, this is the way you're going to call the ball every single time in the future. So I loved it for sure.
I did too. I liked it a lot. That's why I wrote it down.
Yep.
That's why I wanted to perform it, because I was impressed. Good job, Jay. Next, we cut to this point of view, this POV shot, and it's all green. And we see the doctor kind of distorted with some kind of light, and he says, follow the light. And I thought that was a very cool, mysterious moment. I'm like, what's
happening? Yeah. Cause you don't even know where it's at either. Cause you're thinking, okay, it's the doctor's voice. They're clearly in sick bay, but they're
not. What I thought. I wrote it down.
No,
I wrote sick bay. Oh, we're in sick bay. I did too. And then as soon as we jumped out to see, no, we're in the cargo bay.
Yeah.
By Seven's regeneration pods.
That's right.
And Seven is getting this diagnosis. She says that she tried a self-diagnosis.
She did.
She says that the flaw is her human physiology.
Yeah.
She had dizziness. She had double vision. Mm-hmm. She's concluded that it's something called Albright-Salzman syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor's like, well, I don't think that, because that's super rare.
He says the last time someone came down with that was 200 years ago. So, you know, so it's kind of like, I don't think that's it.
Yeah. I love this, though, because it like totally called me out, because I have gone on the internet so many times to Google like
your
self-diagnose
symptoms,
myself. Yeah. And I'm sure that I have this rare disease, right?
Yeah.
Seven did exactly what every human does.
What every hypochondriac human being does.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So the doctor says it's probably just a mild case of sensory aphasia. And he's got a little something for that. He futzes with his hyperspray and gives her a little zhuzh. Yeah. And voila, she can start. It kind of comes into focus. She can see. Everything's good. He starts to head out, and he basically says, next time, just consult me. Don't self-diagnose. Don't Google your symptoms.
Yeah. He says, don't go to the database to find out what's going on. And that Seven has that lovely line. You are the database, is what she says back. So there you go. I love that line.
Yeah. You are the database. And then he responds finally with, yes, with two legs and a splendid bedside manner. It's his final line as he walks out.
Yeah.
We cut out into the hall and Paris is bouncing a ping pong ball.
Yeah. But before you go into Paris bouncing a ping pong ball, again, the episode right two episodes before this, this was 11:59, before that was your episode that you directed, Someone to Watch Over Me.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole Dr. Crush does not play in this episode at all. It's gone. Infatuation. Yeah.
It was the kind of thing.
Yep.
They did not encourage us to hang on to any stories. I mean,
If they bring them up, it's okay. But we weren't able to keep those.
But we weren't able to play almost never. I mean, I do think with B'Elanna and Tom, there was some of that. But again, even with Tom and B'Elanna, there wasn't a lot of opportunity unless they wrote it.
That's right.
To really play that.
That's right.
Okay. But we go out into the hall next, and there's Paris walking along, bouncing the ping pong ball, and he's bouncing it up and out. And I was like, oh my God, I paused. And I was like, I remember this. I was terrified because I had to do the whole scene walking, remembering my lines, bouncing a real ping pong ball. I remember saying to them, like, is this going to be a digital ball?
That's what I thought. I go, there's no way he bounced that ball the entire time.
That was a real ball.
But yes, I figured that out. That was a real ball. And you did a really good job. And I know that you're the only thing that sort of gave off the fact that you were nervous is your other hand. Your other hand was down here, ready to catch if it fell off. It was sort of, typically, you're not going to be all ready to catch it. You're going to be kind of like casual and then catch it. But I could tell.
I did so many takes. I mean.
Oh, no, I believe you.
But there were so many takes where I would be like three lines in and the ball would fall and I'd be like, oh.
I hear you.
And then, okay, got to start over again.
Yes.
And, Yes. And here we go. Action, bounce, bounce, bounce. Couple lines in, falls off. So we did a lot. We didn't do like 25 takes or anything, but we probably did 8 or 10 takes easily because,
But it was smooth. I mean, the end result, the one that they finally used.
Yeah, it worked.
Your dialogue, there's no detection of you being nervous at all. The bouncing looked great. And again, the only thing is because I rewound this, I rewound that scene 17 times. So that, therefore, I was like, oh, okay. His hand is a little
for
nervous.
Real.
His other hand. Yeah. And that's the only thing. No one else is going to see that because they're going to be watching the bouncing ball the entire time.
Well, also, just for the audience to know, that's a real ball in the hallway. But later on in the mess hall, we did some real ball, but most of it was VisFX, if you remember.
Yes, I do recall that.
Yeah, we did do some, but not much, because to get four people to actually play ping pong in a decent manner
going to be difficult for sure.
Yeah, so that was a digital ball later on. But in this scene, to save money, I learned how to bounce the ball and say the words at the same time.
Look at that.
Company money again.
This is Robbie McNeil displaying how he could walk and chew gum at the same time. And he did it. It took him a few takes, but he got it done. So good job.
Yes.
Spark something uncommon this holiday with just the right gift from Uncommon Goods.
The busy holiday season is here, everybody, and Uncommon Goods makes it less stressful with incredible gifts for everyone on your list, all in one spot. Garrett, have I ever told you I have been shopping at Uncommon Goods for years?
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have a membership there that gets me all kinds of perks, including free shipping. You know, every holiday I look for gifts for my kids there, and they're all customized, personalized, and my kids love it. In fact, this last year I got Rebecca a puzzle that was customized with our names as street signs, and it's amazing. It feels store-bought, but it's made just for us.
Very cool. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Many of their handcrafted products are made in small batches, so shop now before they sell out this holiday season.
Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade.
Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, not the same old selections you could just find anywhere. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice.
Wow, that's amazing.
They've donated more than $3 million to date.
Well, to get your 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/TDF.
That's uncommongoods.com/TDF for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
Ohio seniors, make the right call for better Medicare benefits with Medical Mutual. Call 1-866-966-9338 to find a plan today. Enroll by December 7th.
Anyway, she says, oh, that's a curious exercise. And he says, he's got a doubles tournament coming up.
Yeah.
And, it takes a lot of hand-eye coordination.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he realized, wait a minute, she's a Borg.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, maybe you should be my partner. And she's like, no, not interested. And he goes, well, I guess I'll just tell B'Elanna that you're afraid that you're not good enough. And she's like, oh, you're appealing to my vanity. And basically, it works. Basically.
It works. It totally works. But here's my question for you. Why isn't B'Elanna your partner to begin with?
I don't know.
That made no sense either. I was like, I don't understand. But anyway, so you do recruit Seven to be your partner.
I do.
Which is fun. We jump to sickbay, and now Janeway has entered sickbay, and she has some symptoms. She tells the doctor she has nausea and dizziness. And he mentions, oh, well, you're the third person that I've treated for space sickness. And the doc suggests, you know, maybe the inertial dampers are out of alignment. There could be a number of reasons behind this. And he gives Janeway a little hypospray and sends her on the way. And she says, I'll check out the inertial dampers. Now we jump to the mess hall and we have the ping pong match. We have Harry and B'Elanna on one team, Seven and Tom in the other. And I do, now that you mentioned it earlier, that this, a lot of it was VisFX. I was supremely excited that we were actually playing ping pong. Ping pong is one of my favorite things.
That. Yeah.
Oh my God. So I was sitting here going, yes, I get to play something that I've played my entire life and that I relish playing, but we didn't. And that really bummed me out.
It was a fake digital ball. So
I know.
They told us how many moves, you know, what the pattern, what the order was that people were supposed to be hitting.
Yeah.
And you can tell sometimes if you freeze it on a two shot that, like, I was looking down, but Jerry was looking over there. Like,
oh, no, you're not even looking at the same eye line then. No. Oh, good catch. Good but catch.
You can only tell if you freeze it at if the you right freeze moment. It.
Yeah. If you're not freezing it, it's definitely not
detectable.
It yeah, it still works.
Yeah.
We go back and forth. And then all of a sudden, Tom says, say goodnight, Harry. I don't know. And why didn't you say goodnight, B'Elanna? I mean, I thought you would say that, but no, you gotta mess with me.
Yeah.
And you come in for this huge hit, which you did very well. You looked very physically, you know, spry.
I had a ping pong table as a kid myself.
There you go. So another similarity between you and I. And so then you come in for this huge, huge, basically overhand smash, and then the ball freezes. And again, I don't remember the ball freezing before. So I was like, you know, it was kind of cool, that effect there. And Harry goes like, what kind of shot do you call that? When you freeze the ball in midair. Seven pulls out a tricorder where I don't know where she found the tricorder, but she has a tricorder and she reads temporal distortions are afoot. So now we know something's going on, or at least these actors now know, these characters now know something's happening. Mm-hmm. But then we leave. We jump out of that scene, right? We don't really have any explanation except
she reads. No, she reads the temporal distortions. Everybody's kind of curious for a second. And then the ball goes shooting, unfreezes and goes shooting.
Yeah.
And
then it cuts to Neelix, and Neelix is like, it's almost like, that happens every day.
Balls freeze in the middle of a game all the time. Yeah, it was very funny. He's like, no big deal. Back to my pad. Keeping score. By the way, the score was, what was the score?
1918.
Close score. Yeah, close score.
Got to win by two, I think. So, I wish someone would have said, it's haunted or something like that. I mean, it's just like there was no acknowledgement of a ball freezing for about 6 seconds before it moved on. So,
I feel like whatever was going on in the ping pong tournament in this scene, nobody was fazed by the frozen ball.
No.
And later on, when there's literally a shootout next to it, it's like everybody just kind of stands around going, but the ping pong tournament, like nobody dives for cover or like standing there. What?
Yeah.
Who are you? I even say to him later, I'm jumping to the later scene, but I'm like, wait, who are you?
Who? Excuse me.
With the gun and the weird tricorder and the like, who are you? Maybe an invader. Maybe this is urgent.
Yeah.
Anyway, the frozen ping pong ball didn't seem to bother Neelix.
He's
Oh, well.
Yeah.
We go to a cool flyby of Voyager. We cut into astrometrics. Janeway comes in and asks for a report. B'Elanna has been studying these temporal distortions, why the ball froze, what's going on here. She says these distortions are fracturing space-time throughout the ship. Mm-hmm. And we cut up and we see the different parts of the ship that are starting to have damage from these temporal distortions that are damaging the hull. Tuvok says the cause is unknown, but it's emanating from Deck 4, Section 39. It's tearing the ship apart, basically.
Yeah. We got 2 hours before the ship is toast.
Then we go to a three shot. Now, I took a picture in my notes of this three shot. I just want to say something.
Okay.
We may have talked about this before.
Yeah.
B'Elanna's uniform has a V cut that's down.
It's lower.
Almost to her belly button. Okay. Not quite that low, but it's low.
Yeah.
And then next to her is Janeway, and her V-cut just barely crosses over the black line.
Correct.
And then Tuvok's, I don't even think it touches the black line.
No.
Why does everybody have a different length of V
We've talked about this before.
Well, tell me. I remember we did. All right.
So if you watch
this early, your theory?
No, or is not this even my really theory. A this fact? It's a fact. I think Bob Blackman told us about this. So if you look at season 1, 2, and 3 of Voyager, Harry's also ends at the line, just like Tuvok.
Oh, yeah.
And then later it goes lower. It denotes, or it basically shows who is more relaxed. The more relaxed you are and the more in command of everything, it drops lower. If you're a more uptight character, it stays at the line. So
B'Elanna is more relaxed.
See, that's really weird. That doesn't make any sense. It should be the other way around, right? The captain should basically go down to her belly button. Like,
Is it relaxed? Is it confident? Is it?
Yeah.
It's supposedly more in a way, right?
Yeah, I guess. But I think I heard it was about like who's more uptight. the more uptight characters are going to have them stop at the line. Okay. So
anyway, they're in Astrometrics. They just all of a sudden in that three shot, they're lined up. And I was like, what the heck?
Oh yeah.
That's all great. I'm glad we covered that.
Sure.
And by the way, at the end of this scene that we come away with, we realize we have only about 2 hours at the most.
That's right. That's
before these temporal, distortions just tear the whole ship apart.
Mm-hmm.
2 hours.
That's not a lot of time. And not that's the time. End of the ship, basically. Yeah. So now we're in sick bay and we see the doctor is administering a hypo spray to somebody,
a very sick
individual. Yes. And that person is played by one of our regular background actors. And sometimes he also did stand in work as well. Pablo, that's Pablo right there getting the hypo spray.
Love
and I gotta say, Pablo was just, she was doing some acting there.
He was really just. If anyone has ever noticed, Pablo has a huge career in commercials. Mm. He has gone on from Star Trek as a background artist to become a very successful commercial actor.
Nice.
And I've seen him in dozens and dozens of commercials. He's a real actor. And by the way, the thing I love about Pablo is his obsession was salsa dancing. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And he talked about salsa dancing and he would always be sort of dancing off to the side between takes. And I love that he was a big salsa dancer. Anyway,
didn't he write a book as well?
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay. Anyway,
he was a go-getter.
He was always on the set with us. Very good natured. We joked around with him all the time.
Yep.
The doctor then says, an injection a day keeps space sickness away. And Pablo plays a really just not amused at all person and not happy with being sick. So Pablo did a great job there. Nonverbal acting. And Janeway hails the doctor to say that the epidemic has been caused by temporal distortions. And the doctor goes, aha, I figured it was something like that. Neelix then calls the doctor to the mess hall with a medical emergency. Ensign Manus is violently ill. And the doctor says, okay, I'm heading down there. He heads into the mess hall and all is fine. Neelix is there talking about food or whatever.
Yeah, and Neelix is relaxed. Yeah. Offers him a snack. Does not remember calling. He's like, you called me. Emergency. Neelix is like, I don't remember calling you.
No idea.
Ensign Manus is fine. They look over. Ensign Manus seems fine for a second. Yeah. And then he collapses.
And then he collapses.
And the doc rushes over.
Yeah.
And he puts together the temporal distortions. He checks the time on a nearby console.
Mm-hmm.
Realizes that it's 7 minutes earlier in the mess hall than it was in sick bay when he called.
That's right.
So different parts of the ship are now starting to align in different timelines. And that explains why.
That's why.
The call hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. 1543 is the time in sick bay. 1536 is the time in mess hall. So sick bay is ahead of mess hall.
Mm-hmm. We go to the ready room now. And Janeway's ordering coffee black again.
Mm-hmm.
She really loves her coffee, doesn't she?
She does.
I'm glad that I used the mug today, the Janeway mug. I had no idea how perfect our Delta Flyers Janeway I Beat the Borg with Coffee mug.
Yeah. That you can only get through the Delta Flyers.
And how appropriate it is for today's episode.
Very much so. Agreed. Yes.
More coffee for Janeway.
Yeah.
Chakotay comes in. She's like, please don't give me bad news. You know what happens to the people that deliver bad news.
That's right.
Kill the messenger kind of threat. Mm-hmm. He says it's a temporal paradox that time is speeding up in some parts of the ship. It's slowing down in other parts of the ship.
And that the space-time fractures are growing stronger throughout the ship. All of a sudden they have an aha moment talking about how food that was just replicated turns rotten within seconds.
Yeah, she says her coffee
tastes old. Yeah.
Replicated at the top of the scene. She goes, this tastes like it's 3 days old.
Yep.
Yep. So it's starting to make sense.
Yeah. Janeway does come up with a solution. Janeway says she's been working on enhancing the containment fields to keep these fractures from spreading. And right when she says that, all of a sudden you see multiple images of Chakotay. Like he's just,
walking to join her at the desk. It's five or six different phases of Chakotay echoing and overlapping.
Yeah.
And she scans him and finds that the temporal distortion is right here happening. Yeah. There's a fracture one happening right there.
Intersecting the room, and it's expanding. It's getting bigger. And mm-hmm. so Chakotay and Janeway leave with the last comment. Chakotay goes, well, we can test out your theory of the containment fields.
Containment fields.
Give that a shot.
We go in the tube, in Jeffrey's tube. B'Elanna and Seven come out of that Jeffrey's tube door that has the really bad photo backing behind it. It's like, it's all about the perspective. Like, just
it is
move it a little. Anyway, mm-hmm. that really bugged me. Yeah. But B'Elanna says that it's coming from right here.
Yeah.
And they open up the panel, and Seven sees a piece of technology.
Yep. But B'Elanna does not.
Can't see it. Only Seven. So her implants can detect irregularities in space-time.
Yeah.
And they call the bridge. When we cut to the bridge is shaking.
Yeah.
Janeway says, beam that piece of technology off. Tuvok's mm-hmm. like, I can't get a lock on it. Mm-hmm. Harry says, it's starting to demolecularize the hull.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, when you said demolecularize, do you remember? I had a memory. I don't know if I'm right. That you couldn't say demolecularize on the day.
It was very difficult.
I can't even say it now. Demolecularize.
Yeah. It was very difficult.
Do you remember that too?
Yes.
I feel like when we were shooting that scene, you were like, demolecularize.
I was really upset. I was like, I thought so. God dang it. Like, why can't you guys just, you know, the hull's about to buckle. How about that? The hull's about to buckle. That's better than demolecularize.
So funny. Like, I remember that too. It was such a tongue twister.
And it's shocking that you recall that. But it's interesting. You remember my times of stress.
I do. On the bridge. I do. It was very tragic. Difficult
because, like, sometimes it's some of these words that are technobabble words, they end up becoming tongue twisters, in my estimation. It's just not easy to say. So, you know, I mean, you don't grow up. You're not born in the 60s and go through the 70s and 80s talking about demolecularizing anything. Like, no one ever uses this. So
In fact, when I tried to type the word demolecularize, I kept autocorrecting to just the letter D and molecular because it's not a word. Like, it's a Star Trek made up word. There's not a real word of demolecularize.
I feel better now.
I do remember it was hard to say. So in that moment, I was like, I remember Garrett was really getting frustrated.
We're watching that.
I've been there.
Megan goes, you had a hard time with that word, didn't you? I go, yes, I did. That was not fun. Yeah. All right.
We go back to
the corridor.
A corridor, right? And Duquesne and another time ship officer beam in.
Yes.
I love their beam ins, by the way. They have different beam ins. It felt very modern and very cool.
Yes.
Just a nice detail that they mix it up a little.
Yeah.
But they beam in and take off somewhere. We go to the bridge. Harry's picked up a chronoton flux reading.
0.003.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Picked up that reading. And all of a sudden,
Janeway moves up to my station at this point.
Yeah. She's like, wait a minute. I remember that.
And she goes, dry dock. That's what she says. And Harry's like, Captain? And she goes, I remember the chronoton flux from 5 years ago when it was in dry dock. And so this is a big, big, you know, plot point right here. So we know.
Okay. So this is where.
Uh-oh. Here's your problem. Here we go.
So she remembers part of that timeline.
Yes.
But I guess because they haven't like taken her yet and reintegrated all her memories. And
correct.
So she's got portions of the timeline that were corrupted by Seven being there.
Correct.
Okay. I mean, yes and no. It still makes my brain hurt. I don't know. I don't like it.
Okay. So,
but anyway, okay. So she starts to remember some of this. So we realize the dry dock memories are still there for her. And then
5 years ago,
Chakotay talks about temporal distortions are about to destroy the ship.
Yeah.
She's like, we got to abandon ship.
This is huge. Tells
abandon
the crew.
Abandon ship.
Yeah, jump into these escape pods and type in or punch in this heading of 178 Mark IV. This is going to be the rendezvous point for everybody. And we've never, ever done that. So
it's a lot of people, even though we have lost a lot of people.
Yes.
And the random number is somewhere between 140 and 165.
There you go.
I don't know. Somewhere in there.
Do you think we have enough escape pods for everybody?
That's what I'm saying. That'd be a lot of escape pods. That'd be at least like 10, 20. 30 escape pods.
Yeah, I'm feeling like you're doubling up or tripling up or quadrupling up people in escape pods, right? It's not just one per person.
Yeah. I've never seen an escape pod. I wonder what our escape pods look like.
I think we, have we?
I don't think.
No,
I
actually, there is an episode where some of us get into an escape pod and we exit. So this is not the first time we've gotten into an escape pod.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do feel like we've already seen that. And of course, one of our fans are going to.
They're going to remind us.
They're going to remind us.
Okay.
They're going to remind us.
So she says abandoned ship. We cut out in the hall. Seven is walking. I love the cool low angle that
she's moving quite briskly. I don't know if she's
very briskly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But great kind of shot here. And then she runs into Duquesne and he places a device that looks like a mobile emitter on her shoulder. Yeah.
And what does she say though? She says, identify yourselves. And he says, no time, which is a reference back to
the pilot
episode with Caretaker himself. He's like, no time.
There's no time.
So, you know, there's a lot of time kind of references.
Yes, you're right.
Voyager
you're
right. has. So there you go.
I got to say, when he put the thing on her shoulder.
Yeah,
it was similar in size and shape to the doctor's mobile emitter.
Mobile emitter. Different color, though.
Yeah, it was placed on the shoulder like the mobile emitter.
Yeah.
I really wish that they had done something different.
Yeah. I would have loved to have seen him place it on her on her forehead, on her chest, or maybe right on her nose, when he put it on her nose too. So
it's a classic Garrett move.
It is.
Boop, boop.
Yeah, I booped Robbie quite a bit and he would boop me back on the bridge and it was me touching Robbie's comm badge. I would go boop and then Robbie would go, ha ha ha, boop right back. So thank you for booping with me. I appreciate it.
Little right. boop nostalgia.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish they had done it anywhere. It felt like because it was so similar to the mobile emitter, I just think that bugged you. It bugged me.
I know. I knew that was gonna bug you.
So. It bugged me.
It's so anyway. Funny. I can guess when you're gonna get bugged now. So
yeah.
All right. They get beamed out, temporarily beamed out. Right. Mm-hmm. Now we have a interesting shot. What did you think of that shot back on our bridge or that Voyager bridge with Janeway? What is that look on her face? Is that look on her face like, I'm going down with the ship? Is that the look that she had?
I think so.
Okay, so she didn't go to the escape pod. She was like, this whole ship's going to be toast in about 5 seconds.
And we push
exterior,
in.
Yeah,
and
push it on her. Exterior vis-a-vis shot of Voyager exploding. Not a very good shot of Voyager exploding, but it is Voyager being ripped apart.
Yep.
And Janeway of that timeline is no more, unfortunately. So,
well, it was an explosion that was not like a physical explosion. It was these time fluctuations that were ripping the thing apart. So there was sort of a bit of ghostly, like it was a weird explosion.
Yeah.
Like it didn't feel like
a normal explosion, a torpedo ripped
it apart. It was kind of exploding and disintegrating and disappearing sort of. It was very
And then when it came apart, it looked like Voyager was then a puzzle, like different pieces of Voyager were very puzzle-like. And I thought, wouldn't it be like kind of, just evaporate or completely be just, you wouldn't see anything, any debris, but you really see big chunks of debris.
Big chunks.
Yeah. Huge chunks. Quite chunky.
We go to space again. We see the time ship fly by. Mm-hmm. I thought it looked even more like the Delta Flyer from this.
I can't see. All right. Now I got to go back and watch this again. Just to see
it looks
what you're
like a
about.
Giant Delta Flyer mothership to me.
I don't see that. Okay, really? That's fine. No, but I'll have to look at it again. So now we're on the Relativity Bridge and Braxton is greeting her. He's like, welcome back. And he says, we are on the Federation Timeship Relativities. And now you know this is actually a Federation ship. And he tells her this is almost 500 years in the future.
Well, he does say when she first gets introduced, he's like, oh, good to see you again. She's like, again?
Yeah.
And he goes, I keep forgetting. I keep thinking you're going to remember.
She's not.
And I was like, shouldn't you know that? Like, you're a freaking time ship captain. You should know when you pull people in, they're not going to remember.
Yeah.
I thought that was an odd little imperfection of him. I thought you might remember. You know she's not going to remember.
It is odd, but that sort of adds to the fact where you don't, you know, when he does finally
off.
Get out. Yeah, he's a little off. So that you're like, okay, I buy into that. You know, he's a little loopy.
But he does explain, you're now 500 years in the future.
Yeah.
We need your help. Somebody planted this weapon on Voyager. We need you to find it. She's like, why me?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And this weapon.
This is the part that really bugs me.
Oh no.
Okay. So he goes, your ocular implant, it can detect fractures in space-time better than any of our sensors. I call bull crap on that. Her ocular implant is better than any technology time ship specialists have.
Okay.
500 years in the future.
Because really, let's face bull it, her ocular implant are like the Edsel. Okay. The Edsel. Yes. And what they're dealing with is the Tesla, is what they're doing. Yes. They already have a Tesla. They're saying Edsel is more advanced. I knew that was going to get you.
About the timeline stuff and all that. The fact that this whole episode hinges on the belief that her ocular implant can detect fractures in space-time better than any of their technology. But I was like,
they did. I hear you. I know you're upset. I know it pulled you out. But they did add an extra line on there. They said basically, your implants are better than our sensors. But they also add, and plus because of your familiarity with the crew, you will blend in better. They added that. They did add that. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Right. So now she's there to help solve the mystery of this weapon, which basically fractures space-time within a radius of 150 meters. It's called a Force 3 Temporal Disruptor, which is a really cool sounding name, to be honest. Yeah. Force 3 Temporal Disruptor. Yeah. So,
yeah, it's cool.
So now they know this. They know that it was placed on Voyager 2 years before Seven arrived when we were dealing with the Kazon. We're fighting off the Kazon. Shields were down at the time. And that's why somebody was able to get on board and place this temporal disruptor there.
And she's like, it can't be the Kazon.
Yeah,
they don't even know how to make water.
Exactly.
They're way too dumb.
No.
to do this.
And they say, no, it's not the Kazon. It's somebody else, clearly. Mm-hmm. So then Braxton tells Duquesne to brief Seven on their modern 500 years in the future protocols. We have a little bit of a time jump. And now
tell her, by the way, in that scene, they say, look, you've done this for us twice before. This will be your third jump.
Right.
You can do three jumps, but after that, there could be side effects.
Yeah.
That's important that she knows this.
That's correct.
They say that, there could be side effects of sensory aphasia. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It can cause psychosis. So we got to get it right this time. This is your third try.
Yeah.
Anyway, meet me in Holomatrix 1. We're going to practice with the simulation.
Right.
He'll fill you in on all our protocols. And we cut to them doing the protocols.
Yeah, they're doing the protocols. And it's a very wordy scene. My goodness. To have to, both these actors have to memorize that. Bravo. Bravo to them. They have to talk about the Dolly paradox. They have to talk about the Pogo paradox. They have to give an example. Seven has to give an example of the Pogo paradox. And so it's very, very dense. And
I actually like this scene, though, I got to say, because I struggle with time jump stories.
Yeah.
The fact that they were sort of giving the cliff notes of like, here's the issues.
It helped explain it to you.
It just gave some context of what are the potential pitfalls and dangers in these stories.
Correct.
I like this scene.
Okay, good. Good. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it gives you the parameters of what they're working with. And for people that are averse to these temporal storylines, this is a really good primer.
Exactly.
And what did you say? The cliff notes of temporal dynamics.
At the end of the scene, they go through all this. And the one kind of takeaway I had was, she says something like, are you sure this is going to work? And he says, look, I trust Braxton. And she Janeway has taught me about trust and about how that human quality. And so they both sort of bond over this idea of trusting Janeway and trust with Braxton, which I think is important because that's going to play out later on.
Yeah, because Duquesne says, I trust Braxton just like you trust Captain Janeway.
Yes, exactly.
So there you go. That's setting up. That's sort of a setup for later. We do jump to the Relativity's Holomatrix, where Seven is with Braxton, and Braxton has basically set up what it looks like of where, the exact panel and how, where this temporal weapon is located. And then he goes into this long diatribe about how Janeway. Horrible Janeway is. And just like, she's reckless.
I've had to clean up her mess so many times.
Three major temporal incursions that I had to take care of. Janeway is just somebody who has messed everything up, poking her nose in where she doesn't need to poke it in. I was stranded in the 20th century for 3 decades. But actually, Bruce McGill, you weren't. It was another actor, so you didn't have to deal with that. And Braxton, the final mandate to Seven from Braxton is avoid contact with Janeway. That is an order. I mean, he's very clear cut about it. Don't even let her see you. You know, so you now get a little sense of Braxton does not like Janeway.
He does not like Janeway.
No,
nope,
not a fan of Janeway. We have a little bit of a time jump. We're still on the relativity. I like that one line that Braxton says. We have a saying in our line of work: "There's no time like the past." I thought that was kind of funny. I like that.
After "there's no time like the past," they do basically put her undercover. So they occlude her ocular implant on her face. Mm-hmm. The Borg implants on her hands disappear. Yeah. They have a close up of her at the end of the scene where she goes up to reach for her ocular implant over her eye, and you see her hand is clean. So thought that was a nice, like, simple little storytelling beat of, we're showing that, and we're having a tender moment of her sort of acknowledging this.
Yeah.
It was nice.
Yeah.
And then Duquesne gives another countdown and he goes through the jump. I love it, Jay. It was great.
Oh my goodness. Exterior shot of Voyager fighting off the Kazon. And now we're in the Voyager corridor. Seven has beamed in. People are running everywhere. Shot is of crewmen or background actors running one direction, running another direction. Now we're on the Voyager bridge. Janeway calls for evasive maneuvers. Paris has a couple of lines there too. We're fighting off the Kazon. And now we keep jumping back between the bridge, the corridor, the bridge, corridor. We see Seven walking very quickly. And then we see the engineering room. And Janeway is telling Torres that she needs warp engines. Torres says, "Look, I can't give it to you. I have to repair the containment generator. I need 10 minutes.
At least 10 minutes.
Yeah, at least 10. We jump back to the Voyager bridge. Harry picks up the chronoton flux of 0.003 from deck 4. Tuvok incorrectly says that it may be random interference from Kazon weapons fire. Janeway crosses over to Harry's station like she has done over and over again. And she says that she has seen these readings before. So we have another scene like that. Jeffrey's tube again. Seven's
back in the Jeffrey's tube. Mm-hmm. Opens the panel.
Yep. The but weapon's not there. It's
no
gone.
Sign
it's,
of the weapon. This
yeah, it's
time,
not gone. Right? It hasn't been placed yet. That's what it is.
Hasn't been placed. Yep. Mm. Back to the bridge. We find out that the lead vessel, the lead Kazon vessel, has been disabled.
Correct.
But the Kazon are regrouping, and Chakotay says, "Let's go to warp." They
yeah. Torres says, "I can give you warp 2 only." And Chakotay goes, "I'll take it."
And he says, "Let's go." Paris does it, and they take off. And the Kazon did not pursue. Mm-hmm. But Janeway continues thinking about this flux, and she remembers the dry dock in this timeline. They never found the cause of it, she said. And so she says, "I want a level 10 force field around that section immediately."
Yep.
And Chakotay, as she walks out, he's like, "Are you sure you want to focus on these sensor ghosts right now? Like, you know, maybe this isn't where we want to put our energy." And she's like, "No, this is important."
Yeah.
We go back to the tube. Seven picks up the force field that's been created.
Yeah.
She tries to reach the time ship, but it's blocking communication with them.
Yeah, they can't hear. And
the time ship is trying to compensate, but they're locked out. We go in the hallway.
Yeah.
And Seven exits the Jeffrey's tube here and hits a force field. She's trapped in this intersection.
Turns around.
Mm-hmm. Janeway and Tuvok are there. They got phasers pulled.
Janeway
says, "Who are you?" And Seven's like, "Just drop this, you know, let me out of here.
Yeah.
This is very important.
And I can't tell you. I can't tell you. I can't give you my designation." Yeah.
And then Janeway's like, "Wait a minute. I do remember you. I know who you are. Utopia Planitia? Is it Utopia Planitia or
Planitia?
Planitia. That's right. Autocorrect on my phone." Yeah, she does remember her. Utopia Planitia, she says. And then we cut over to the time
you
ship.
You should say Panera Bread. That is where she.
Autocorrected to
Panera Bread. Yeah.
But I love when we cut over to when Janeway does remember, we cut over to the time ship and Braxton simply goes, "Oh, Janeway."
She's so upset.
He hates Janeway.
But Janeway even says, "I remember you." Efficient. Yeah. Like she, you know, and it's almost like that is the reason why she had to say it in her weird Borg delivery, you know, because Janeway remembers that in a way, right? But then, you know,
Janeway should be doing a podcast because she remembers everything, unlike yours truly, who can't remember anything.
Okay.
Janeway remembers even efficient, ensign who's used the word efficient in the briefing.
That's right. That's Janeway. But I don't think Kate Mulgrew, the actor that plays Janeway, will remember everything.
I don't think
Janeway does. Okay. So Seven keeps withholding information. She doesn't want to give up her cover. Tuvok detects Borg implants.
She was ordered not to even
talk to her. Avoid
talk
contact.
To Janeway. Right. Avoid contact.
Yeah, and she's doing pretty well. Then Tuvok detects Borg implants on her, and then Janeway's now, oh my gosh, scan for Borg vessels in the vicinity. You know, Janeway will not release her until she gets more information. She wants to know what's going on. Finally, Seven knows time is of the essence, and she finally gives in and she spills the beans. And what really convinces Janeway to drop that force field is Seven's comment, "Captain, when you take me from the Borg, you are going to tell me that part of being human is learning to trust. Trust me now." And that line is which pulls Janeway in, and she says, "Force field, lower it now." Tuvok complies. Communication is restored with the relativity. Braxton wants to beam her out. And Seven says, no, wait a minute. You know, that's defeating the purpose. I'm already here. I'm pursuing the saboteur with Janeway's assistance. Mm-hmm. Cuts back to Braxton, who hears with Janeway's assistance, again, a roll of the eyes. He's like, fine, proceed. Just do it. Nosy Janeway. So Duquesne, he then throws out Tempus Fugit. Do you remember that? He speaks a little bit of a Latin there. I had to look it up. Time flies. That's what that means. I had no clue. Yeah. But that's what made Braxton say, proceed to Seven. And she does. They wander into, or they crawl into that Jeffrey's tube, Janeway and Seven. And you see a shadowy figure about to place the temporal disruptor. And of course, the reveal is it's Braxton. Braxton. And I'm wondering, did Bruce McGill also decline the gold suit and say, "I want a green one as well"? I don't know. I feel like he should have been wearing gold. But this Captain Braxton is clearly a bit deranged. He's evil.
Braxton.
And he's suffering from temporal psychosis. So nothing is up is down. Down is up to this man. Yeah. And he basically says, the only way to heal my temporal psychosis is to destroy Voyager. So he's on a personal vendetta. That's what we find out. This has nothing to do with the Federation.
If he can destroy Voyager, it will prevent his illness from ever happening.
Exactly.
So he's on this mission. Yeah. We go to the timeship bridge, and Duquesne now arrests future Braxton.
Yes.
And he says, you know, for crimes that he's going to commit
in the future. I'm like, what?
Okay,
is this Minority Report with Tom Cruise? What's happening
again,
here?
Again, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
This is like a timeline ethical puzzle.
It bugged you again, didn't it, when he said that? I knew it did.
Yeah, you start playing with time and all of a sudden, like...
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, Duquesne, everyone else follows Duquesne's orders. So he relieves Braxton of duty, arrests him, and then orders Seven to apprehend Braxton. But then Braxton beams out.
He's got his tricorder and his weapon with him, and he beams himself out.
He's beamed 2 years. He's jumped 2 years earlier. And Seven asks Duquesne, "Let me follow him." And Duquesne's like, oh wait a minute.
It's your fourth jump.
It's your fourth jump. You really want to do this? She goes, "I'm doing it." So he doesn't argue with her. She jumps.
She jumps. We're in a hall where she jumps into this hallway. She's leaning on this railing.
Yeah, obviously she stumbles.
Suffering from this jumping.
Mm-hmm.
Janeway is giving a tour or getting a tour from the Admiral.
Mm-hmm.
And she sees Braxton running and she throws the Admiral down. I'm just going to start with this whole section and say the action sequences of this episode are not... our best work.
Okay.
It's just not shot like actions. you know, there's a shooting vocabulary that you need to make these things dynamic and feel
okay.
And protect the actors from looking kind of goofy. And
I hear you. But again, I forgave all of that. I was like, I'm okay with that. What really bugged me is that as Braxton just, you know, like a bullet in a china shop, he's running through, Seven's chasing him and shoots him and hits him on his shoulder, and he keeps running. And I'm thinking, what kind of phaser, what kind of cockamamie, you know, maybe phaser were you given from 500 years in the future?
I had the same thought. I rewound it. As he's running, he sort of dodges to one side. I think the story they were trying to tell was
that he dodged the shot.
He dodged it without looking. He happened to know if I go left, I'll dodge the shot. And I think she missed him. That's the only explanation I could come up with. Like, okay. Why is he ducking to the left?
Okay.
Thing hits. I don't know.
This is what I felt. I thought he got hit and that made him stumble to the side when he got hit, like, ow. And then
it was confusing.
It was very confusing.
Not a great, again, this whole section of action, including our ping pong tournament that's coming up.
Yeah.
So none of it felt very... The stakes didn't feel very real or dynamic, and the shots weren't really great.
All right, I'm going to go with your explanation that he dodged it, but that's going to set up my argument later about the ping pong scene. Yeah. So it's now Janeway now erects force fields, which stops
for force fields for all the exits. Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Braxton is stopped by the force field. Seven catches up to him
again. He stopped by running into it and bouncing off like a Three Stooges. It was not very well done.
He bounces off like a ping pong ball itself. Did. And he then beams out again, but this time 5 years into the future.
Yep.
Seven's like, Duquesne, shoot me that way too. So she jumps after him. Now this is her, fifth time that now she's beaming? Yeah. Yeah, okay. So now they're 5 years into the future. We have the mess hall. The ping pong match is going on. Braxton runs in, chased by Future Seven. Paris is like, who are you? And again, you're not happy with this. I get that. But here we go. Seven clearly shoots his tricorder out of his hand and shoots. Now, you do agree with me. She does connect with her phaser on Braxton in this scene. Yes?
Yes. Yes? She connects to the tricorder. But what I was about to say is
she shoots him first. He falls back. She shoots him square in the chest. He falls back. He's still standing. She shoots again and knocks the tricorder out. I think then she shoots him a third time. It's sort of like, wait a minute. That phaser from 500 years in the future is like a pop gun. It's like it doesn't do anything. It's the worst phaser ever.
It's the worst phaser ever.
Oh, agreed. My goodness. What?
Ugh. Agreed. It's not good.
Goodness.
It needs some inserts and tight shots and close-ups and... It just needed more shots, and action takes time, and they must not have had the time.
Nope.
To film it. But Paris does call for security, and he's now lost his ability to jump any further. So he's now on foot.
Yeah.
Paris and Harry run after him. Seven goes herself.
Well, actually, Future Seven is Future Seven stump falls down to the ground. She's totally affected by her now fifth jump. And current seven goes over to future seven to have a little conversation. Hey, what's going on? And Future Seven says, it is all up to you. You must capture him.
Your future depends on it.
And then Future Seven is beamed out by Duquesne. We do have a shot back on the Relativity where Duquesne is scanning or doing some type of diagnostic on Future Seven to make sure she's not going to croak again on that bridge. And she does. And that's the funniest thing. She's been beamed six times to go back to Relativity, and she's still alive. So that's very impressive. Now we're in the Voyager corridor, and Braxton is cornered. And we finally got him. He's beamed back to the Relativity, and Janeway walks over to check on current Seven to see if she's okay. She's asking for details. And at this point, before she can get an answer from current Seven, Janeway herself gets temporarily beamed to the Relativity. So our story and our plot thickens. We're now on the Relativity. Duquesne is there saying, I need your help, Janeway. I need your help to clean up this timeline, because we have 15 people that have seen Future Seven run into the mess hall. We can't have that. We need to be able to, you know, not have this incursion in the timeline. So we need you, Janeway, to go back before everything happened and
prevent
get that
the
Braxton.
Chain of events.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Get Braxton.
And Braxton, because for leniency, because he's already caught, he's agreed to provide everybody with the exact time, the exact location when he first beams in the corridor before he places the temporal disruptor into the panel. And he even says, one thing that happened to me when I first beamed in is I stumble over a crew member that's
everybody in this episode remembers a lot of detail, I gotta say.
Yeah, they do.
And by the way, besides all the detail, I noticed in this particular scene that Jeri Ryan had a cold. And you can hear it.
You can hear it in her voice.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I didn't really notice it in any other scenes, but in this scene, I could hear she was very stuffy.
Okay.
Had a cold. So
good catch.
Interesting real life part of our show.
Very much so. And that is when he stumbles over the crew member, that is Janeway's chance to apprehend him. He'll be sort of on the ground and without what he needs to do to repel, to get her away or escape. Mm-hmm. Janeway is temporarily beamed to the Voyager corridor where Torres finds her. She has to interact with Torres, past Torres.
Now, did you notice in this scene? So this is back in the Kazon battle day. That's the timeline we're going back to. B'Elanna's makeup and hair looked a little different. It looked back to first season.
Oh, okay.
And no, in a good way.
Okay.
And she's interacting with this time jump Janeway who doesn't have a bun. And
she should have caught that in a second, right?
She says, I thought you were headed to the bridge. Why doesn't she say, I've never seen your hair this way, Captain? Why doesn't she say,
Captain, where's your bun of steel? I have not. Wow. I like this look on you, Captain. It looks fabulous. So,
but she doesn't say that. Instead, she says, he's going to get the warp core back online. Mm-hmm. And I think she says,
she asks for advice. And then Janeway says, you know, do what you think is best.
Yeah.
And
do whatever you think is best. Yeah.
Then she goes, aren't you heading towards the bridge? Because no, I've got to take care of something. So then she dismisses Torres. Torres doesn't think twice about it. And then as she's running around the corner, she sees herself, Captain Janeway. So she hides from herself. Mm-hmm, hides from herself, and her other self is giving commands to another crew member. And so then she rounds another corner and she kind of waits. And then that's when she encounters Braxton showing up and falling just like he said he was going to fall. She apprehends him. The next shot is back on the Relativity Bridge. And we have Duquesne doing some calculations and he's impressed. He goes, incursion factor 0.0036. That's better than I expected. So Janeway's action really kind of set all the timeline back so that there's only really 0.0036 of any type of diversion or any what's the term I'm trying to say?
Fluctuation.
Yeah, any fluctuation. There you go. Yeah. And so Duquesne says, all right, I'm beaming both of you back to your timelines. They're standing there next to each other. See you in the 24th century, says Janeway to Seven. Seven says, I look forward to it. Or should I say backward? Janeway says, don't even get started. And that's the end of that scene and the episode. So they beam out.
Yes. Wow.
Ohio seniors, it's time to make the right call for better Medicare benefits with Medical Mutual. Plans start at $0 per month and include $0 doctor visits and $0 generic prescription drugs. Visit medmutual.com/review or call 1-866-966-9338 to find a plan today. MedMutual Advantage plans are HMO, HMO POS, and PPO plans offered by Medical Mutual of Ohio with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in a MedMutual Advantage plan depends on contract renewal.
Okay. What is your theme? What is your theme?
I know your theme. Never do temporal timeline storylines.
I wrote
ever.
Down my theme. Time travel gives everybody a headache. Don't do it. That's my theme. Time travel stinks. It hurts my brain and every part of me.
My theme, my lesson is part of being human is learning to trust. That is going to be it. I'm going to use that.
Good. That's
and it's
good
true.
One.
I mean, it's true. You have to, you do have to trust. That's a huge part of the human condition And a lot of times people don't have that trust, and you need to have that. So
great.
I'll go with that.
All right. What's your rating on this?
I'm going to give this episode I'm going to say 7.7. That's really? What I'm going to rate it. Mm-hmm. Nice. Out of 7.7.
Okay. I am going to, there were a lot of good guest stars in this. I think Jerry did a great job. I think everybody did a nice job, but I am not a fan of these timeline stories that mess with all the canon, all the previously, the continuity and with characters. And it just feels like cheating. So I'm giving it a 6.
All right.
I'm giving this a 6 because it had some good stuff, but not my favorite.
Okay.
Okay. What'd you give it? 7.7?
7.7.
Okay. Our Captain and Admiral average rating for Relativity is 7.9.
Oh, thank you.
Wow.
Thank you.
You're very close.
I have been close to 2 in a row now, actually. So
yeah,
I'm pretty impressed. All right, everyone. Thank you for tuning in this week to the Delta Flyers for Robbie and I's discussion of this crazy episode, Relativity. Join us next week when Robbie and I will be discussing the episode Warhead.
Whoa, wait a minute. Warhead.
That's
the next one. Okay.
Yeah. Are you getting a little feeling of something?
Maybe.
Something. Okay. I'm going to give you a hint right now.
Okay.
Harry's in it a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right. Anyway, thank you, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next week.